Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Supreme Court rules unanimously in the ballot access case, or does it? Trump builds a decisive lead over Biden in the polls, or does he? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Noah Rothman, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods. Jim Garrity, you are, of course, listening to a National View podcast. Our sponsors this episode are the How the World Works podcast from CEI and ExpressVPN. More about both of them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So, Jim, the Supreme Court came down unanimously in terms of the Colorado action can't stand, and Colorado doesn't have the authority to do this. There was a disagreement about whether a majority had gone too far, but this was not a surprising decision. I forget whether you were on when we predicted what the breakdown would be, but it was either 8-1 or 9-0, according to everyone. And I'm happy to say I was 9-0, and I was kind of right. Although, as Andy points out, it's sort of a 5-4 decision wrapped inside a 9-0 decision. What do you make of it?
So I think the morning after Colorado announced its decision, I was on Hugh Hewitt's program, and Hugh confidently predicted it would be 9-0. And I think my attitude was, yeah, it ought to be that, but I hope it's that way. I hope it isn't 8-1 or 7-2 or something, that some liberal justice says, well, if you squint and you look at the Constitution this way, you can justify this. Wrote about this both for NR and for the Post. And look, I'm not a lawyer. I am a layman, but I was just like, wait a second. If you're going to throw Trump off the ballot because he's committed a crime, shouldn't he be convicted? Shouldn't he be at least indicted? Jack Smith is not a forgetful kind of guy. It's not like we've had a lack of Trump indictments around lately. You'd figure that would have been in there somewhere. And Trump had not been indicted on this, much less convicted on this. And I had more people tell me I was an idiot and I didn't understand anything about the law. I didn't know anything about this. And it was self-evident that Trump had committed insurrection.
Who called you an idiot? Chris Saliza? What's the hall of shame this time, Jim?
So Ilya Soman over at Reason. There are certain times I want to name names and spike the football.
Jim,
you don't know the first thing about this. Well, maybe I do, right? Maybe this does not pass the sniff test. And, and by the way, if this Colorado Supreme Court can't just unilaterally decide, well, we've decided that Trump has committed this crime, therefore he's constitutionally ineligible to be president. Well, then the main Secretary of State can't. I think everybody could see, wait a second, the can of worms you're going to create. Because if this could go forward, what would stop any, red state Supreme Court or red state Secretary of State saying, well, it certainly looks to me like Joe Biden has committed bribery with all the Hunter Biden shenanigans. Therefore, I'm declaring him ineligible for the to be president, and I'm throwing him off the ballot. At minimum, if you're going to say somebody's constitutionally ineligible, you should have a conviction. That seems, you're putting the cart before the horse here if you choose to do that. Came out 9-0. I'm glad it did. I will point out, though, that the reaction of liberal media and legal world was to totally ignore that it was a unanimous decision, at least, and granted, Andy's point. There was apparently an interview on MSNBC where somebody was asking either the Colorado Maine Secretary of State, and the question was, do you believe the Supreme Court is partisan? It was 9-0. Where's the partisanship? How is, you think the vast right-wing conspiracy? They got to Sotomayor and Kagan and Jackson. They've all been compromised. That's Keith Olbermann stuff, who, by the way, said that those three justices were illiterate, that they couldn't read, that they had problems with reading comprehension. And let me tell you, Guys, I find it intolerable that Keith Olbermann is attacking minority women judges this way. It's just disgraceful.
So, Noah, the practical argument, as Jim alluded to, that if you have just a bunch of states deciding which presidential candidates are going to be on the ballot or not, it's just going to create a totally unmanageable system. Then you have the legal argument that the 14th Amendment empowers Congress for enforcement. And yes, the states could do this if Congress passed a law telling them they could do it. But in the absence of that, it's not a state power.
That's the majority decision. And as I understand it, having not actually gone all the way through Amy Coney Barrett's concurrence, there's a little bit of a notion here that you can challenge that further down the line from state officials. And there probably will be a challenge at some point to this rationale, but it doesn't apply to Donald Trump's case. This is done and done. And it should be. And I'm kind of mystified by the reaction that we've seen from partisan far left Democrats who somehow, I suppose, convinced themselves that this thing was on firm legal ground. I don't know why. They had evidence in the form of other states, like Minnesota, for example, that took up this claim and found that it was wanting because of the 14th Amendment's restrictions on candidates who, quote, engage in insurrection. And that just simply did not apply to Donald Trump in their reasoning. And it was only this one vote, 3-4 vote, of the Colorado Supreme Court, aside from the individuals like Maine's Secretary of State or Attorney General, I forget, who have pursued this on their own, that this is a very tenuous legal rationale. And the life cycle of this thing was remarkably short. It found its way into a legal journal, I believe, in August of 2023, and then to the Supreme Court less than a year later. That's a shocking alacrity to adjudicate this issue. And it speaks more, I think, to the mindset of those who pursued it rather than the kind of sober jurisprudential philosophy upon which it was based. It was the nearest weapon to hand. And because of that, when this came down in December, I had to make an admission significantly against my own interest, because I have long maintained that, and we've gotten in arguments about this, Rich, that all of Donald Trump's legal troubles, I would say the vast majority, if not all, are attributable to his own personal conduct and the reactions that his personal conduct inspires among people who dislike it. Can't really say that about this one. I've had to concede that when the Supreme Court issued this ruling that it did yesterday, that a certain measure of political persecution has been directed against Donald Trump unjustly. I don't know how else you can evaluate what the Colorado Supreme Court did and others have done in trying to extirpate him and only him from the political process with this one neat trick. It was obviously extending beyond their remits in order to, because they don't trust voters' judgment, in order to take that option away from them. It was very imperious. It was unfounded. And the Supreme Court's ruling, regardless of how it shakes out in the 5-4-9-0 debate here, is not really relevant. This is a significant rebuke to a resistance legal theory that hopefully will be internalized by those who pursued it.
So, Charlie, feel free to react to anything you've heard, but I'm particularly curious what you think of the argument from the progressive justices that the majority went too far and seems to be foreclosing other forms of federal enforcement of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment and just didn't need to reach that issue to decide the fundamental issue of the case, and what you think of Amy Coney Barrett's concurrence that I was a little annoyed by. I think it's sort of the scolding tisk tisk. Let's not have strident disagreements in our opinion because politics is so volatile at the moment. I'm just not sure that's the role of Supreme Court justice to be scolding her colleagues in those terms. But what do you think?
I think that the 9-0 portion of the decision is clearly correct. And it shows how willing progressive journalists are to claim the Constitution means whatever they need it to mean, and how likely the press is to repeat their outlandish claims as if they had merit. In an area I write about a lot, this manifests in the form of the collective right theory of the Second Amendment, which is a conspiracy theory, but that is praised frequently in The Atlantic and then repeated every time CNN publishes a piece on firearms. This was the election's version of that. The sub-question is a lot more tricky. I've seen people, including Andy McCarthy, and far be it from me to disagree with him, describe this as a 5-4. I think it's more of a 5-3-1, and Andy does acknowledge this, in that Amy Coney Barrett does not actually tell us what she thinks on the merits. It's possible she would have been with the majority but didn't believe the question needed to be reached. Did the question need to be reached? Yes and no. I think in a vacuum, the non-originalist justices have a point that the question before them, the controversy before them, had to do with the states. Are the states allowed to disqualify a federal candidate for office? The answer is no. As a result, one could make the case that they did not need to reach the secondary question, which is, by what mechanism would the federal government achieve that? The problem with that as a practical consideration is that we are about to have an election. Now, I'm not saying that means the court should have decided the federal question in the way that it did, or even that it was right. I simply don't know enough about whether or not the original understanding of the 14th Amendment included some sort of due process requirement in addition to congressional authority. But I do understand, given that that question has rarely been asked, rarely been litigated, rarely been written about, given that it is not a subject that has been presented to the court before, and given that we are now hearing rumblings from the Democrats that they are going to respond to a potential Trump victory by refusing to certify him on the grounds that he's an insurrectionist, I do understand why that issue was reached. I suppose I'm agnostic on this. That doesn't mean I don't care or there isn't a right answer, but I don't really know what it is. So I'm not annoyed by the majority opinion. I'm not annoyed by the three non-originalist justices, and I'm not annoyed by Amy Coney Barrett either. I can see that one being resolved in any number of ways, and the practical question being resolved in any number of ways as well. What I think is important here, and what the press has done a lot of work to downplay, is that the central claim of this case, the one that was endorsed by all the people we're supposed to respect and listen to, was bunk and was shot down 9-0. The last time this happened as emphatically as this was the recess appointments case from the Obama era, where all the bien pensant class, the New York Times and the Atlantic and elsewhere, was so sure that this lawsuit was frivolous and that Obama could do whatever he wanted with the appointments power. And it came down 9-0. Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined the opinion, and the press went hummina, 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 as it has here. And that's why you've seen all of those headlines in which it is not emphasized that this was 9-0. And on the central controversy here, which is the behavior of Colorado's legal apparatus, was resolved without dissent.
So, Jim Garrity, next question to you. We've seen some commentary now on the left saying, you know what, maybe this whole legal strategy against Trump isn't working so well, and we'll actually have to defeat him at the ballot box. A guy at Vox wrote this. I saw a headline at Slate today saying the same thing. So the exit to you is the lawfare campaign against Donald Trump succeeding or failing?
Largely failing. My understanding from reading Andy is that the only trial that is likely to have a verdict or before Election Day is the one up in New York about the Stormy Daniels payments, which I don't think is going to be a bombshell. I think even a bunch of Trump's critics, even David French and David Frum, have said this: if you're stretching the law, this does not sound like a particularly strong case. So my answer is no. The other thing I'm going to remember, just, you know, set me down memory lane. Way back when the Obama birth certificate, the birth, you know, controversy arose back in 2008, and before that, there was this talk about the Whitey tape. You know, there's always this belief that there's some sort of silver bullet that will make the opponent that is really hated by the other party's grassroots eliminated. They'll disqualify him. And so then you don't have to beat him at the ballot box. You don't have to beat their arguments. You don't have to win. It's just going to, we're going to find this magic wand, and this magic wand will make this person either ineligible to be president, or they'll just blow up their reputation and everyone will hate them forever and all that stuff. And I don't think it's a very good habit to be looking for this magic bullet solution that's going to disqualify your candidates instead of, you know, doing the hard work of making a stronger argument to the entire electorate.
Noah, succeeding or failing?
So I think we need to refine the premise slightly.
No, I hate premise refinement, Noah.
I apologize. You're
crude. At the risk crude of questions.
I will be obnoxious. If you see quotes on background, not attributable to any individual person, but Democratic political officials breathing a sigh of relief in the wake of this particular verdict, because it would have been politically disastrous. That they say, yes, the way
to just embarrassing to have Democrats trying to keep the guy off the ballot and politically disastrous.
Yeah, it's very, yeah. And this is, we shouldn't forget that this legal theory originated with conservative legal thinkers.
Yeah, a couple.
Exactly. But yeah, so there's a distinction between that and what I think you're referring to, as well as it, lumping it in with the criminal cases.
Yeah, no, I am.
Themselves also need refinement. Like the Bragg case is not the same as the Jack Smith cases, etc. And in those cases, sometimes when we discuss them, there's this modest bit of throat clearing at the top, where it was, of course he did it, but you know, we got to talk about the nuts and bolts, this, that, and the other, in order to justify or discern whether the prosecutions are justified. And those are still percolating. We haven't seen them reach fruition. So I'm hesitant to render a judgment on those. When it comes to this sort of thing, an effort to extirpate Donald Trump from our political process with the stroke of a pen, that's obviously a failure. And not only a failure, but has been undesirable from those who would otherwise welcome this sort of thing. Donald Trump's opponents have not really been warm to it. So yes, I would say that's an utter and complete failure.
Charlie, Lawfare succeeding or failing?
I think on balance it's failing, but broken record alert, I want to distinguish between the validity of that Lawfare and its results, because it is possible to have a case that is sound and should have been brought that backfires politically. Mm-hmm. Those are and ought to be separate questions. One of the political downsides that I identified from the get-go with this particular attempt is that it will allow, and I suspect we're about to see this happen during the course of the election campaign, Donald Trump to tell many voters falsely that the question of whether or not he was responsible for January 6th was considered by the Supreme Court, and it decided 9-0 that he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
The legal nuances of this question are not going to be debated in great detail in the country at large. This will look to a lot of people like an affirmation, not of Trump's claim that the election was stolen, but of his defense against any suggestion that he did something wrong or engaged in insurrection or encouraged the crowd or what you will. And politically, again, the legal questions notwithstanding, politically, that is an absolute disaster for the Democrats that they should regret having unleashed.
So I asked this question once before, I believe, I'm almost certain, on the second episode of the week. So it was Maddie MBD, Charlie and I answering it. I think we're all, yes, it was succeeding just in terms of the time and resources it was draining from Trump. And I think that's still true and still meaningful. And whether they'll actually get a conviction that matters very much remains to be seen. So my answer is a little bit evasive, but I would say not succeeding as much as they had hoped yet. With that, let's go to our first sponsor this episode. Our friends at CEI are back with new episodes of their breakout How the World Works podcast, hosted by author and political commentator Kevin Williamson. If you're not already listening to the show, each episode, Kevin sits down with notable guests for candid conversations about the jobs they've had and the role of work in the economy and our social lives. From flipping burgers and tending pigs on a farm to leading special ops missions in far corners of the globe, some of America's best thinkers discuss the jobs they've had that inform their outlook on life and future careers. In a recent episode, Kevin sat down with Jonah Goldberg, both of whom are old friends and colleagues of National Review, of course, for a fascinating conversation about the ins and outs of Jonah's decades-long career in the media. So be sure to listen to How the World Works wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit CEI.org/How the World Works. That's CEI. That's the Competitive Enterprise Institute, by the way. CEI.org/How the World Works. Please check it out. So Noah, you are, as we know, a bit of a polling maven. We had a bunch of polls over the weekend that all pretty favorable to Donald Trump. CBS had him at 52% against Joe Biden. I posted on the corner, this had to be the highest rating for Trump in any general election poll ever. I looked back in 20, of course, he wasn't anything close to that. In 16, he was at 50 a couple times, maybe twice. But then I was just scrolling prior to this segment through the RCP polls again, and he's actually been at 52 and 53 in a couple other polls just the last month or so. I consider those findings outliers, but outliers, kind of one thing they can do is either identify a trend or identify the range. And Trump's range seems to be higher than what everyone would have naturally thought is his ceiling. What do you make of it?
Yes. So the CBS poll is really the only independent poll to have Donald Trump getting a majority of the vote. You have the Harris polls that Democrats have a huge problem with for a variety of reasons. And I'm not inclined to entirely dismiss them. I'm inclined to, you know, give them a side eye. But nevertheless, taking their objections at face value, which have to do with the priming that respondents are treated to ahead of the head-to-heads, which is not best practice. Nevertheless,
yeah, as I'm looking, yeah, all the above 50s are Harris.
Harris polls, from Marquette. Yes. So let's concede.
There was a Marquette that had him at 51, but yeah, the rest are Harris.
And Marquette is a good pollster, so you can't dismiss it offhand. But nevertheless, let's concede the Democrats' point for that, for the sake of argument. You still have very high quality pollsters over the weekend: CBS News, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Siena, all of them demonstrating that Donald Trump is approaching his vote share in the 2016-2020 elections, which is, 46-47% and more. CBS News actually gave Joe Biden a better vote share than he normally enjoys, too, at 48%. Nevertheless, you know, take the top lines out, and the big picture that you're seeing is Donald Trump has a pretty stable, small, but stable lead over the incumbent president. Democrats are quick to tell you it's very early in this sort of situation, and they would most likely cite things that caught my eye, for example, in the New York Times Siena poll, which is this double hater phenomenon. So candidates who have an unfavorable view of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Donald Trump actually comes out not ahead in that contest. In New York Times Siena, Biden leads Donald Trump 45-43 among voters who dislike both candidates. And that's an unusual place for Donald Trump to be. In 2016, double haters, which was a meaningful demographic, broke for Donald Trump. In 2020, it wasn't really a meaningful demographic because most Republicans liked Donald Trump and most Democrats liked Joe Biden. He only had about 3%, but those 3% broke for Donald Trump. So Donald Trump has rarely been on the wrong side of voters who boil this down to a binary choice and hold their nose and vote. He ends up doing better. But it doesn't matter if Joe Biden's constituents are so unenthusiastic about the prospect of voting for Joe Biden. Joe Biden's voters are extremely depressed in a way that even, and it would benefit Democrats to acknowledge this, but they don't really want to or can't. One of the more interesting findings in that, again, that New York Times Siena survey is that among Democrats, 28 describe themselves as enthusiastic in their support for Joe Biden. Among Democrats, 30% describe themselves as enthusiastic for Donald Trump's renomination to the presidency. They're more excited to vote against Donald Trump than they are to vote for Joe Biden. That's a terrible sign.
Do you know what was that true in 20?
I don't know if that's true in 20. I would very much doubt it. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden was really well liked by Democrats in 2020.
Feels like that's where Democrats have always been, you know, whether it's Hillary or Biden, that they're more animated by opposition.
Maybe more animated, but they liked Joe Biden in ways they mm-hmm. don't anymore. Mm-hmm. They've shed a lot of their favorable impressions of the president. And maybe that'll be fixed by an ad blitz. I kind of doubt it. There's some sense among those who are trying to make these distinctions when they're Joe Biden supporters are trying to make distinctions among polls. For example, they'll say, yeah, these are high quality pollsters that are showing Joe Biden up. But if you look at the online panels, right, well, they're showing Joe Biden doing better. And those aren't really high quality pollsters, but they capture a different universe of voters who maybe don't answer the phones, what have you. So one of the distinctions that they try to make when they're assessing this thing is that it's very early. And, you know, Barack Obama fielded an ad blitz against Mitt Romney. And it was controversial insofar as it was so early in the general election cycle. Mm-hmm. And when did that happen? July of 2012. Mm-hmm. We have so much time left before mm-hmm. we even get to the remotely conventional stage of the general election race. Well, that's not going to be true this year. The general election is going to be upon us far earlier. He's going to be pressured. The president is going to be pressured into establishing the basis of his general election themes against Donald Trump early. There's already a lot of pressure on him to do that. There's pressure on him to go out there and goad Donald Trump into being in front of the cameras more, because they want the public to be reminded of who he was. And that's only going to make Joe Biden more visible. And the state of the race has been really static, with the exception of it began right around November of last year that Donald Trump began to really break away from Joe Biden, and has been that way for some time. And what do you think that has to do with? I mean, a lot of Democrats will say that has to do with Israel, but it coincides with the fact that Israel's war erupted at the same time as a variety of attacks on the United States and its allies that Joe Biden has mishandled. So the exogenous conditions to me seem like they're shaping voters' impressions more than what Joe Biden is or isn't doing. And I just don't know if he has the tools to fix it.
So Charlie, just putting aside the head-to-head numbers, just Biden's ratings alone on everything are in the toilet, flashing the brightest red possible. Approval rating in a lot of these polls under 40%. You know, it's a horrible place for an incumbent to be. Fox asked about 8 issue priorities, from the border, where obviously he's going to be in terrible shape, to climate change, where you think he'd be okay. Majorities, a couple of these issues, just 51%, but on several much more than that, say he's failing. They say his economic policies have hurt them more than helped them, just on and on and on. So it's hard for me to see. And then there's obviously the age thing, which has gotten even a little worse in some of these polls. It's hard to see how Biden is going to improve his standing much. It's all going to depend on tearing down Donald Trump.
I agree. One of the biggest mistakes that center-left people in this country make is that they think that Joe Biden has been a good president who is unfortunately very old. And Joe Biden has been a bad president who is unfortunately very old. Joe Biden is not a good president. He's not even a mediocre president. He is a bad president. People dislike him because he's dislikable, both personally and in terms of his policy. People blame him correctly for certain changes he made to the status quo. They blame him for spending too much money when we were clearly headed for inflation, and for then lying about that inflation, saying it wasn't going to happen, and saying it was transitory, and downplaying it. But he still is. I'm told that at the State of the Union, he's going to complain about corporate greed and shrinkflation. He can try, but it won't work. because people blame him quite rightly for making a problem that was going to be there anyway, partly as a result of Donald Trump's failure to rein in spending, worse. People dislike him because he took a border that wasn't perfect, but was better than it had been for a long time, and via sheer oppositional defiant disorder, reversed all of the policies that had helped. Now, there are some of those policies that needed to go, and I wrote this, because they were tied to COVID-era emergency rules. But not all of them did. And there are provisions in the law that could be implemented right now by Joe Biden to improve the situation. He hasn't. That was a deliberate choice. People know it. Afghanistan. Those press conferences where he said, oh, you won't see chaos, you won't see death, you won't see aircraft leaving with people desperate to get onto it. We did. Yeah, he's old. Yeah, that makes it worse. Yes, his polling would be better if he were 43. But he's also been a bad president. And people understand that. So yeah, the disastrous chaos that Donald Trump brings with him is Joe Biden's best asset. But it is simply not the case, as I keep seeing claimed in centrist political outlets, that the public just doesn't understand what a good job Joe Biden's done. Nonsense. He's a bad president. He's also an extremely old president. And it might cost him.
So, Jim, another element of these polls is you see a kind of Trump, I wrote about this today, kind of a Trump nostalgia. So his retrospective approval rating, something like 46%. It was more like 41 when he left office. 65% of people think the economy was good when Donald Trump was president. When he left office or right before the election, his approval rating on the economy is about 51%. It was much higher than that prior than COVID. But people are looking back on Donald Trump more fondly than they did in January 2021.
Yeah, look, if you know Trump's well, you could argue what Trump's worst baggage is, what his biggest weakness is, general erraticism, temperament, ignorance of the Constitution. I could go on all day. But the best thing going for Donald Trump is that as of like February 2020, people would be perfectly happy to reelect Donald Trump. If the COVID had not happened, it's an excellent chance Trump would have won reelection. The economy was humming, wages were going up, and people have happy memories of that. And that's what they want to get back to. And so this utterly, the most abnormal man in America is now running as the candidate of a return to normalcy. And I don't know whether Trump can necessarily deliver that. I think that a second term of Trump would be very different from the first. You would not have all those, stable personalities around him. He'd be surrounded by sycophants and yes men. But people are going to say, I dislike what's going on with this so much that I'm willing to roll the dice on that, or at least right now. By the way, like each week, Rich, you ask us roughly, do you think Trump's going to win or do you think Biden's going to win? I was looking up these numbers
Don't answer that. Don't answer that right now because I'm going to ask it.
Okay. I will allude. Okay, so Noah was going through the past history. I wonder, do you want to know the least amount that anybody, a lowest percentage of the popular vote that anybody's gotten since the year 2000 was John McCain, 45.7%. Not that low. Like that's the floor for a Republican candidate these days. The second lowest, ironically, is Donald Trump in the year 2016 with 46%. That was enough to win if you have just the right, breaks in just the right states. The lowest for any Democrat was 48.1 by Hillary Clinton that year. By the way, I'm getting a real Hillary whiff from the Biden campaign these days. You read that New Yorker article, in which Donald and the rest are like, "No, polling is broken. We're doing fine. This country, this election is going to be about January 6th and democracy." Boy, they are convinced they're managing this correctly, and they are convinced that they are well ahead. And I just, you don't have to look for David Axelrod to find Democrats who are like, "I'm not sure about that." You seem awfully confident for these sorts of situations. So it's all going to be somewhere in the mid to upper 40s for each side. Maybe you get more for the no labels candidates, although once again, at this point, No labels is no candidates. Nikki Haley really kind of slammed the door on that on Friday. I was at an event with her in D.C. on Friday. So we don't know how big a factor no labels is going to be. RFK Jr. is going to get some votes. Cornel West will probably peel some off on the left. But Trump, this is not mission impossible for Trump. You know, and as much as Charlie makes a great point that, yes, Biden is old, but he's also bad. But I would point out, he's also old. And by that, I mean, Nate Silver, just like 2 weeks ago, I mean, this very obvious point. It's like, okay, Biden White House, if this guy's terrific, because you tell us behind closed doors, he's doing cartwheels and he's sharp as a tack. And when the cameras aren't on, he's just so good. He's like, put up or shut up. Have him do interviews with the Wall Street Journal. Have him do heavy duty interviews and show us exactly what this guy is. And then Joe Biden went out and he had ice cream with Seth Meyers. And he described a peace proposal between the Israeli and Hamas, a ceasefire, that nobody else in the Middle East had heard about. Which raises, once again, raising the question, how much does Joe Biden remember from his presidential daily briefing each morning? I have my doubts.
Yeah. So Noah, as Jim said, I ask it a lot, I'll ask it again. Focus on Trump this time again. Percentage odds that Donald Trump is the next president of the United States. Zero, not going to happen. 100, it's a lock.
That's an interesting way to reframe it. I'm going to say 45%. I will not reevaluate my assumption that the incumbent is the favorite in this race until late summer, until the conventions. And if the polling environment still looks like it looks today, then I'll reevaluate.
And so where are you on Biden?
55-45.
Okay.
As it looks today.
Someone had some percentage for someone else. I forget who it was. I thought it might
Marianne have been. Marianne Williamson Momentum.
Yeah. I do think it's a problem. I think, you know, the Jill Stein, Cornel West thing is a problem. Even the RFK thing.
The RFK thing is a really big deal for now. So it makes you wonder just what the resources are that both campaigns will commit to the RFK, you know, defining him campaign, mm-hmm. which given where he's polling, almost 10% nationally, probably worse on the ground in the states where he's managed to make the ballot, it's going to be a big headache. And right now, it looks like it's drawing from Donald Trump or from Joe Biden, which isn't what you would expect given where his appeal is. His appeal is among Donald Trump's voters. But yeah. Joe Biden is so soft and so weak, and he's doing this, you know, as Jim said, the Warner Brothers Frog Act, where he's, you know, he's in just really unimpressive in person. But if you see him behind closed doors when the cameras are off, man, this is great. The campaigns are going to have to, and probably the president's campaign is going to have to devote some resources to defining some of these alternative candidates negatively, just in order to stave off the drift of his own voters.
Yeah. So with RFK, yeah, the appeal in terms of his anti-establishment message is, you think, draws from Trump, but the name draws from Biden. Charlie, percentage odds that Trump's the next president?
I'm still where I was, which is that Trump's problems in the suburbs are such that Joe Biden remains the favorite. I am less sure about it than I was. Maybe I should change my number from 45-55 to 48-52, but... Or I could try and have it both ways and say that I'm 45, but also note that I'm not sure about it so that I can claim at some point in the future that I nailed it. Right, either so way, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Yeah. But I still think that those same dynamics obtain.
So, Jim, we got a 45 and between 45 and 48 with a note of modesty to it. Where are you?
At this moment, I feel like Trump is a very slight favorite. So put me at 51. This is going to come down to, look, everybody in America knows what they think of these guys. That there's no new factor that's going to make people see Biden differently or going to see Trump differently. It's going to come down to a very small sliver of the electorate that doesn't like either one of them and has to decide, you know, the double haters, and they got to decide which one do they hate more. And the argument of the Biden campaign is sometime between now and Election Day, voters are going to remember why they hated Trump and why they didn't want to vote for him in 2020, and they'll come back to our side. What hasn't happened yet, and I don't know what's going to happen between now and then that's going to suddenly cause this sudden exodus of people who are like, I don't like Trump, but I prefer the economy back then, and Biden seems too old and doddering to get this done, so I'll roll the dice. Like, could it happen? Sure. But I just don't see something happening, and I also think that Biden's getting worse, and I think the fact that you know, the response to the Nate Silver challenge was ice cream with Seth Meyers is a sign this guy can't do. Like, the Democrats are going into a, you know, huge all the marbles campaign with a guy who can't campaign, which I think is an indicator that, you know, he should not be considered the favorite heading into November.
Yeah, I just wonder with Trump, it's not as though he's become more personally popular. It's just people think, all things considered, he was pretty good at the job and better than the incumbent at the job. So they can convince people he's a terrible person, but I think that they're already pretty convinced of that. They have to convince people that Biden has done a better job substantively than Trump. And that's a much more difficult proposition. That said, I'm also going to stay where I've been, 50-50, tempted to tick up to Garrity territory at 51 or even surpass him at 52, but I'm going to stick to 50-50 for now. Same grounds, Noah, just wait for a little more time to pass. With that, let's go to Charlie to hear from our second sponsor this episode, ExpressVPN.
Indeed, ExpressVPN, which I use myself on all my devices. There's a reason for that. The internet is still and should be the Wild West, but unfortunately, the Wild West did have some outlaws in it. Have you ever heard of a data broker? Well, that's the middleman who collects and sells all of those digital footprints that you leave online. And they can use these to stitch together detailed profiles, which include your browsing history, online searches, and location data. That data broker then sells your profile off to a company who delivers you a really targeted ad. No biggie, right? Well, you might be surprised to learn that these same data brokers are also selling your information to the Department of Homeland Security and the IRS, and I, for one, do not want either of those showing up at my door because of some search I did on my phone. So to mask my digital footprints, I protect myself with ExpressVPN. How does this work? It's actually ingeniously simple. One of the easiest ways for brokers to aggregate data and tie it back to you is through your device's unique IP address. But because that remains constant across the internet and is unique to you, it also reveals information about your location. But when you're connected to ExpressVPN, your IP address is hidden. You tunnel through theirs, which is shared by thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, and that makes it much more difficult for data brokers, or anyone for that matter, to identify who you are. That's another benefit. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your network traffic, which keeps your data safe from hackers on public Wi-Fi and elsewhere. And that's why I use ExpressVPN on all my devices, my iPhone, my iPad, my computer, and so on. And all you need to do to turn it on is tap one button and you'll get protection. It really is that easy. So if you want to make sure your online activity and data is protected with the best VPN money can buy, visit expressvpn.com/editors right now. If you do, you'll get 3 months extra free, but only if you use the special link, which is expressvpn.com/editors.
So Noah, Kamala Harris gave a speech about Israel where she said a few appropriate things about Hamas. They should accept a ceasefire, release the hostages, et cetera, et cetera. But the balance of it and the emotional part of it was really hitting Israel and portraying or implying that Israel is waging an immoral war where it doesn't really care about the humanitarian suffering in Gaza. What did you make of it?
There was some throat clearing. That's all you can call it in her speech delivered at the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Alabama, in which she said, yeah, Hamas should, you know, shouldn't be in charge of Gaza after this war. Didn't call on them to surrender, which would actually put an end to this war rather quickly, but should give back the hostages, shouldn't be in charge afterwards, just nods to where the vast majority of American public opinion is today. What she really devoted her passion to, and what we've seen since she delivered this speech, was actually watered down, according to some reports, that she wanted to be even more vociferous in her attacks on Israel, is that her passion is for the far left wing of the Democratic Party's opinion that the moral reprobate in this conflict is Israel. And it comes on the heels of an administration effort, a theatrical effort, to indict Israel for failing to provide humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. That's all you can say of the airdrops of aid over Gaza from the administration military officials over the weekend. And now we're talking about introducing aid via the sea, just, you know, putting pallets of aid on fast boats and having them, you know, just hit the beaches, I suppose. It's solipsism. And it's really rather disgusting. The notion that Israel, which they're trying to promulgate, that Israel is throttling humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip is betrayed by your study of how Israel has tried to provide for civilians in Gaza. It negotiated with Egypt the opening of the Rafah crossing on October 18th. Aid began flowing into Gaza on October 21st. Mid-December, it opened the Kerem Shalom crossing directly from Israeli territory into Gaza in order to introduce properly inspected aid into the country, despite, quote, threats of sniper fire, anti-tank missile shootings, and other threats to civilian life. The Israeli government maintains as of yesterday that some 14,000 trucks have delivered 267,000 tons of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and it is being administered by Israelis at the risk of their own, of the IDF and their own lives. There was this big kerfuffle last week over two simultaneous events that have been conflated in the minds of Israel's critics. One, a series of trucks delivering aid was set upon by a mob of very desperate Gazans. The situation in Gaza is horrible. We should note that. Set upon by this mob, the trucks were scared. The drivers were scared. They drove into the crowd in order to save themselves, wounded hundreds. Simultaneously elsewhere, a cache of aid that was being administered by IDF soldiers was similarly set upon. The soldiers felt themselves substantially intimidated to the point where they began firing warning shots above the heads of the demonstrators and eventually fired at their extremities. And the only reason why we know any of this is because Israel released all this information. Israel released the drone footage of this mob of desperate civilians going after this convoy. They released the preliminary investigation, which cited behavior by their IDF soldiers that was not necessarily, we shouldn't say condemnable necessarily, just understandable, but nevertheless, a catastrophe. The only reason why we have this information is because Israel is the only honest partner in this war. You have Hamas on the other side, which nobody takes seriously unless they can demonstrate that 30,000 Gazans have been killed, eliding the number of civilians and Hamas fighters in that total. That gets bandied about all the time. But the administration can't take those numbers seriously. And when they do, there's a big scandal, as occurred with Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who recently repeated those numbers, only to be rebuffed by his own staff. This administration is in a very strange position where it is constantly lending credence to Israel's critics at the expense of its own objective. Joe Biden has committed American capital and prestige to Israel winning this war. The Biden administration needs Israel to win this war, and it needs to win it with all due alacrity. The longer it goes, the worse the situation gets for them politically. And yet every action they take seems to undermine that objective, both rhetorically and in the provision of this aid from the air, for example, which John Kirby said would probably be taken by Hamas and extend their ability to resist the Israeli onslaught. That is against what the administration needs. Do they know? Are they aware that they need Israel to win this war and they need him to win it fast? It doesn't seem like it. They're caught in this weird rhetorical trap in which they want to give credence to the anti-Israeli left and give them succor, and at the same time not give them enough succor to demonstrate that they're on their side. It's an unwinnable position. Midge Dechter said, you have to join the side you're on. Mm-hmm. And this administration seems incapable of doing that.
So, Charlie, another aspect of this politically was in the Michigan primary. There was an effort to have people vote uncommitted as a protest against Biden's support of Israel. The organizers, as organizers do, set the bar very low. 10,000 uncommitted votes, they said, would be a victory. They got, I don't know, 100,000, I think about 13%. Of the vote, which is not that much higher than the uncommitted vote against Barack Obama in 2012, or when Barack Obama was running in Michigan in 2012. I'm not sure how meaningful this is. Clearly, the White House is obsessed with it, but very few of these people, I think, would actually not show up or not vote for Biden if the contest is Biden-Trump the way it will be in the fall.
Yeah, I think that was a damp squib, really. As you say, the difference between Obama and Biden is 3%. That just doesn't seem to me to be important at all. And you can make an argument it's statistically insignificant. If you think that that 3% could mean something, it could also mean that Joe Biden is not Barack Obama. Barack Obama was one of the most talented politicians of the last 50 years. He was really good at getting himself elected. Joe Biden is not that. So I just don't think this is an issue. What I think is happening here, though, as I often propose in other contexts, is that the Biden White House is surrounded by and informed by, some would say run by, the progressive blob. And the progressive blob is in a different place on this conflict than is the country at large. And it does affect you if you hear arguments made day in, day out. That's how a lot of our politics work. It's why we have regions that have politics and characters. You go back to the founding or pre-founding of the country, to that book, Albion Seed, you see this creeping in. The way people thought in the West Country of England translated to the regions that they inhabited when they crossed the Atlantic Ocean. Of course, the Biden administration is more sympathetic to, if it's earnest, or bound to, if it's not, people who are skeptical of the justness of Israel's cause. They're surrounded by those people, punctuated by those people. So I think this is not really manifested in the numbers or in any concrete evidence. But I think that it is promulgated from the left elite class that, as with student loans and other unpopular policies, has a direct line to the president and has used it to great effect.
Yeah, Jim, the war in Israel, war in Gaza, has ended up being a real wedge issue against President Biden. Wedge issues where your base puts you in an awkward position vis-a-vis the rest of the country, and Israel is still very popular in the broadly with the American public. This war is considered a just and necessary one, but you have his base. It's totally in a different place, and you see him trying to straddle.
Rich, for a moment, I thought I was going to have to take a drive down to the smokestacks of the Rothman premise refinery and adjust the premise there, because it felt a little raw and we brought it out of this 55-gallon barrel. So I wrote about this after the Michigan primary, that if you look at overall polling, support for Israel is still pretty darn solid. And even in Michigan, it's no better than a 50-50 issue. It's actually like a 30-30-20, not sure, in terms of like, is Israel doing too much, doing too little, et cetera. So it really isn't a slam dunk winner, even in the state of Michigan. Now, in Dearborn, yes, right? There are parts of Michigan where Biden's policies of being relatively close to Israel, certainly at the very beginning, I think we can all agree it has dissipated month by month since the October 7th attack. Is it probably going to cost him some votes? Sure. But if Biden were to flip, or the more he drifts away from support of Israel, there's an offsetting cost amongst other voters. And it's not just only going to happen in the state of Michigan. It's going to happen. I guess the Biden campaign doesn't want to compete in Florida this year. They say they do. But I guess, it's not like there are any Jews who live in Florida. It's not like there are any Jews who live in Nevada. It's not like any Jews who live in Pennsylvania. Hey, who cares about those states, right? We all got to do everything we can to win Michigan. There's two things that kind of jump out of it. The first is the degree to which there's this belief that if Biden changes enough, that the people who are calling him Genocide Joe are going to come around. It was genocide for a while, but he recognized a Palestinian state, so it's all hunky-dory now. Color me very skeptical. I think these people are going to go for Cornell West or find some other option or stay home. But at the same time, it will alienate all of the pro-Israel Democrats. Are there as many as there used to be? No, but they're still there. And those folks, they might vote for Trump. Probably not. They might vote for whoever No Labels puts out there. They might stay home. They might leave that part of the ballot blank. You know, there is a cost to making this shift. And then, say, you know, in politics, you got to dance with the one that brung you. There's no way that Joe Biden, who has up until recently described himself as a Zionist, can reinvent himself as a, you know, vociferous critic of Netanyahu and the Israeli government and a steadfast friend of the Palestinian people. It's just not going to shake out that way. The other thing is that, so this is coming from the person, like, we're all like, oh my God, you know, Biden looks so old and decrepit. He, you know, wondering about his memory. He looks so bad. Skips, you know, boy, this is a really lousy time for Kamala Harris to screw up. This would be a time for Kamala Harris to bring her A game and make Democrats feel really confident about her. And this speech does not do that. Mm-hmm. Coming out and say, you know, like, this is like, hey, progressive left. I mean, what Charlie characterizes the progressive blob. This really feels like an administration that spends a lot of time on Twitter or X, or maybe Facebook, Instagram thread, wherever the online left is now. It feels like an administration that is just soaking in it, like Palmolive. And it comes out in their decision-making. It comes out in the say, because in the minds of the left, support for Israel is deeply controversial. And in the minds of the American electorate as a whole, it's not at all controversial.
Yeah. So she's by and from the progressive blob. And apparently there's a report that the speech was watered down by national security officials before she delivered it. Noah, exit to you once again. First, Israel's winning the war in Gaza, yes or no?
Yes. They're on the 5-yard line. This, which is why it's so inexplicable. This administration is right where it needs to be. Now, for the people who are anti-Israel haters on the left, who think the occupation didn't end in 2005, they'll continue to say that there's an occupation and that's an intolerable moral hazard, et cetera, et cetera. But the war against Hamas is going exceedingly well from Israel's perspective. And it's getting close to the point of victory, which is what Joe Biden needs. He should midwife it into existence.
Charlie.
I don't have Noah's granular knowledge of this, but from what I've read, it seems as if the answer is yes.
Jim.
As far as I can tell, yes. I just want to throw out that there's a online posting going around from Ibrahim, who's a Gaza resident, who collected the food that the United States airdropped into Gaza, the humanitarian aid. And he declares on this video that he's disposing of the trash and says, this is the translation, American aid has reached us, but it ended up in the garbage where it belongs. We would rather starve to death than eat from it. Well, Ibrahim, go starve then, because if the United States and its people are going to go try to help you people and you guys are going to reject it, you deserve what you get. We're trying to help you out, pal. If you're not willing to do, if you don't want it, we're not going to give it to you. And I think it makes the Biden administration look really stupid, like we're bending over backwards to help people who hate us. So, like,
aren't actually starving.
Correct, you know, but how starving are you, right? You know, just an observation that the Biden administration, if we help the Palestinians, there are all these votes to win. You sure about that? Because they all sure look like a bunch of ingrates right now.
So I think the answer is yes, but the big question is what to do with Gaza after they actually win. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, robotics and the Model UN, huge in your neck of the woods and Authenticity Woods. Your neck of Authenticity
Yes.
Woods.
Authenticity Woods in Fairfax County. By the way, it's not the real name of my community. I'm not telling you where I really live. I am blessed with two brilliant teenagers. And I remember growing up and in my lovely high school in North Mallrat, New Jersey, you could say, we had a lovely teacher who liked to put up, whenever somebody's name was in the paper, they put up on a bulletin board. So you'd get like the honor roll, which by the way, I was only on once in a great while. You have your name listed. Maybe the school play would get like one picture. And then like athletics, the whole billboard would be covered. High school athletics were covered a lot. And you look back and you're like, you know, maybe we should find other ways to recognize kids' talents and skills and that they're good at something and celebrate their accomplishments. Well, let me tell you, here in Northern Virginia, we treat robotics competitions and Model UN the way they treat high school football in Central Texas. This is a huge deal here. I was picking up my younger one from the Model UN competition. And let's just say a really exclusive public high school in Northern Virginia, not to name names, came out they clearly had done very well, and they get together in a big circle, and they're whooping it up, and they're booting their chests, they're high-fiving, yeah, we won Model UN! Yeah, they just went crazy. And I actually felt good for these kids, and I'm just kind of observing, like, remember, kids, nerds and geeks are people, too. I was one myself, and it's kind of great to see that you don't have to, that there are more ways to be a kid or a teenager, go out and do something and be good at it, and get recognized. I just think it's really fascinating that what we used to associate with like high school athletics being the big man on campus, the big person, you know, now you can do it in a whole bunch of different areas. And so,
how do you win Model UN? Is it judged? Are there judges?
It is judged. Let's just say the Garrity household has had a couple gripes about the judging every now and then, but the Garrity household has also racked up some accomplishments. So
argument is the most morally bankrupt we've heard this afternoon. You win.
Thank you. I was going to point out that I don't have the heart to tell my younger teenager that the real UN doesn't do anything useful.
Yeah. No, one word.
You should do Model NATO instead.
I love that. Yeah. I have recommended to my younger son to go out and, you know, nuke them at the first opportunity.
Noah, guns.
Yeah. So I'm not a huge gun guy. I just, they do nothing for me. It's like, American football. I'm aware of it. I don't hate it.
Oh no,
it is what it is. but my family is
apathetic about the existence of God, and Noah's apathetic about American football. Who's worse?
Just American football by the size of it, and guns. What else do you hate? Kittens as well.
You know, you don't want to get me started on Model UN. So I don't. We're just going to leave that there. So my family is a little bit different from me. My father enjoys guns. My brother enjoys guns. So as a Christmas gift, I found a local range that where you can fire off automatics. So we went and shot 1919 Browning 30 caliber and a 9mm Uzi submachine gun. And I thoroughly enjoyed the experience insofar as it was really shaky and the vibration was cool and the big noises were cool. I did enjoy it more than I thought I would, believe it or not. I'm not going to go out and get myself a semi-automatic, but it was definitely an enjoyable experience. So I'm exposing myself to new things and maybe changing my opinion a little bit on them. I'm not, you know, unfortunately, I can't go out and get my own.
You watched a playoff game at a neighbor's house, if I remember correctly.
I mostly ate sandwiches and drank hard seltzers, but the game was on.
Hard seltzers. You were just digging a hole for yourself in this episode.
True. Yes, my man card.
Charlie, what's been going on?
I had a friend, a very long-standing friend of mine, visit at the weekend. It was great to see him, and he brought me some really beautiful hard wine from from Spain, and it wasn't a wine that I'd heard of before. I was sure it would be good because he has great taste in such matters, but it was spectacular. We drank a bottle of it last night. And, oh, man, I haven't actually told him this yet. I'm telling our listeners this, although he does listen to this podcast. But what a lovely surprise. So if anyone else wants to send me exotic wines, please feel free and limit any seltzer gifts to Noah's house.
So I like spring training. At least I like when it starts. The problem is it really drags on. So now it feels like it's forever. You know, it was such a great thing when the pitchers and catchers reported and then they had the first game. And I don't like the spring story sports journalism, spring training sports journalism, because it's always like this guy's in the best shape of his life. You know, he's going to bounce back even though he's 37 years old, which never pans out. But it just feels like now it's going to take forever to actually get to March 28th, which is the Yankees opening day. With that, it's time for our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
Okay. So I'm going to do two, but they're almost like twins of each other. Luther Ray Abel, writing about the U.S. Coast Guard, quote, homemade ships are dumb, Coast Guard edition, and kind of tag teaming with Dominic Pino, writing by ships that exist. And as I understand it, the Coast Guard needs an icebreaker. They could have bought one that was already made by some foreign manufacturer like 7 years ago. They were trying to find a U.S. manufacturer to make it. 7 years have passed. The ship hasn't even gotten started on. It appears like now finally they're moving in the direction of saying, you know what, maybe we should build a ship that already exists for about $150 million instead of waiting for a next generation icebreaker, which would cost $745 million. I work with really bright colleagues, some of whom are like just shockingly young, but they just know so much and explain it so well, so clearly, such a fantastic demonstration of common sense and how it is desperately needed in all kinds of corners of our government.
All right, hear, hear. Noah, what's your pick?
It's going to be Dan McLaughlin's hate and acrimony undermine a unanimous Supreme Court in Trump eligibility case. Dan has been sort of specter-like as a part of this podcast because he helped me understand this ruling, and I suspect some of my other colleagues as well. He takes some issue with it insofar as the court didn't weigh in on whether Donald Trump had engaged in insurrection. I don't know if that was necessarily the court question before them exactly. It was whether or not Congress or state officials could invalidate Trump from the ballot. And I think it's an adjacent issue to the case, but not necessarily the central case before the Supreme Court. Nevertheless, Dan's analysis is stellar, helped me in ways that I couldn't understand it otherwise, and I highly recommend it.
Try.
I'm going to choose a magazine piece, The Enduring Appeal of J.R.R. Tolkien. I always enjoy the literary pieces in the magazine. They're a nice break from politics, and it's a smart decision to have them at the end of the magazine, because when you start at the beginning and then by the time you get about two-thirds of the way through, it's all very depressing, especially at the moment. And then you go into the literary woods and there's this...
At least Tolkien's still good. At least we still...
Yeah, birds are singing and there's beautiful green foliage everywhere, and then you leave and you think, wow, everything's great, until you open the next one. Anyhow, this is a really great piece. I think there is a mystical connection somewhere between J.R.R. Tolkien and National Review, in the same way there's a connection between Evil and War and National Review. Perhaps it's the Catholic link, but I have heard more talk of J.R.R. Tolkien and Evil and War at National Review than at any other venue in my life. And this is an excellent addition to the canon.
Yeah, I think Rick Brookhiser and his wife read The Lord of the Rings out loud to each other, or at least they have. So I'm going to violate all the rules and pick one of my own pieces, but it's in a good cause because we have a webathon going. So I posted the initial appeal. If you can help us, that would be great. We always need a little additional income from our supporters and believers in the cause and NR. And this is a so-called dual giving case, which means you can give either to NR, which is in theory a for-profit enterprise, or to the National Review Institute, which is a non-for-profit where your contribution will be tax deductible. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or count on this game without the express written permission of National Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Noah. Thanks to How the World Works and ExpressVPN. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.